Problem Gambling Podcast is proudly sponsored by Gamban, the simple and effective way to block access to online gambling on all your devices. If willpower slips, Gamban doesn't. Go to Gamban.com to find out more. Hello and welcome to the Problem Gambling Podcast. I'm Barry Grant, an addiction counsellor with Extern Problem Gambling. And my co-host is Tony O'Reilly, also an addiction counsellor with the project and the co-author of the book Tony 10. And today we're delighted to have with us as our first guest on this new season, the brilliant Claire Dunnigan, also from Carlo. I'm surrounded by Carlo people today, who is the CEO of a new organization called Thrive Recovery, which he's hopefully going to tell us all about today, and is herself in recovery and may tell us a little bit about that today. Claire, how are you doing?
I'm great. Thank you, Barry. Thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about what Thrive Recovery is and what's going on there.
Thrive, right. So we are a new organization, as you said, and the idea for this came about basically when I was in my own recovery. I'd say I was about maybe 6 or 8 months into my recovery, and I was working for an agency as an education support worker. And I'd worked for them for 5 years on and off, and I'd never say I had a great relationship with them, but I worked with them, and I was placed in Carlo at the time with this girl who'd had a stroke, and she was in a wheelchair. So my job was, you know, I'd sit in the classes and I'd take notes, and I'd help her with whatever she needed. So I was doing that for 4 months before Christmas, and then they locked down again. And so she decided to go to a rehabilitation center. So I was out of work for that time, and didn't think much of it, just thought I'll be back in a few months doing my work. And then I got a phone call one day, and it was from the disability officer in Carlo, and she said, "I'm really sorry, but I have some bad news." And it was that this girl had died, the girl I was working with. And obviously, because I worked very closely with her, it hit me hard. But I think what hit me harder at the time was that the agency that I'd worked for 5 years never rang me, never emailed me, never once got in contact with me to tell me this news. So my actual employer never even bothered contacting me. And I would see them on LinkedIn, and I would see them putting up, you know, all these posts going, "Congratulate this person. They're 1 year working with us in the office." And they never even bothered making a phone call to me to tell me that the student I'd worked with died. So I think at that point, I had been thinking about recovery in general and the things that I would like to do to help other people, because I felt like I really had to make my own journey in recovery. And because at that time that employer had treated me so badly, I just felt like, right, this is the time now. This is the time where you kind of make or break, because you've been floating around doing different jobs, just keeping your head above water, and you need to find something that you really love and that make sure that you're never treated like that again as well. So you kind of make your own way. So, you know I was about 8 months into recovery at that point, but I couldn't get the journey of recovery out of my head. I got into it, and I, you know, I was eating a lot better. I was exercising, and I was taking one day at a time, as you do. But I felt like very lonely, because I hadn't done a 12-step program. I hadn't done residential, and it is a very lonely journey. And when you don't have a peer support network, it can be very hard. But so I started thinking about what are the things that I wish I had right now, and I wish I'd had the whole way through. And I kept thinking, if only there was, you know, a program that wasn't based in a 12-step, because I hadn't related to that. And, you know, if there was maybe some sort of platform or some sort of online group that I could access and have a peer support network built around that, it would have helped me a lot. You know, I wouldn't have felt so alone the whole way through. So I started thinking about how I was going to do this, and I started doing a diploma in coaching. I don't know what possessed me at the time. I thought maybe I should go into counseling. Then I thought, God, no, I'd be no good at that. So I thought, well, coaching, that's a good idea, and you'll get a qualification and it'll hopefully help you decide on what you want to do. And honestly, when I did it, I didn't know what I was doing. But the more I got into it, the more it really opened my mind to a different way of thinking, a different level of my own recovery that had never been, I suppose, suggested to me, but it really cemented my own way of sustaining recovery, if that makes sense. So I learned new things. I learned about values and belief systems. I never knew what, you know, self-limiting or enabling beliefs were before, and learning about that alone blew my mind. So I thought, this is fantastic, you know. So anyway, I finished that, and I'd say I probably arsed around for a long time, but I eventually did figure out how to put that in a program with my own experience. And I think what it looks like right now is a 12-week recovery program, which is based in peer support and practical advice, but is in no way treatment. It's definitely holistic support. So that's why I suppose it's more an aftercare program. But I would say it doesn't have to be, because sometimes you will have tried everything else and maybe this is the thing that works for you. Because what I found with a 12-step program was there are kind of rules that you have to follow, and I didn't connect with that. And what I've done here is created, like, there's 60 something pages in this program. It's all very basic information on different topics, but it's not in any way saying you have to follow this. It's just, here's the information, here's some peer support along with that, and you know, you decide what's going to work for you and what doesn't. So it's just about trying to provide people with practical, you know, tools and help them connect with each other. So that's, I suppose, the other element I have to go back to, is that along with the program, there is an online platform where you can have your own profile, you can have chat facilities, make your own groups, access to further support groups afterwards. So the idea is that you're never alone, and that you can decide how much or how little you want to use that, but it's always there for you. And I think my hope is that that way we can build a peer support network in Ireland that doesn't have to be a system that you have to follow religiously, you know. Because I have built a peer support network, but I really went out my way to do that. And the majority of the people I talk to probably daily are in the UK, because that's where my work brings me right now. So yeah, I do some work with other organizations at the moment as well, while we're setting this up and getting it going. But yeah, hopefully it will, you know, people will understand and connect with this program, because it's about them. You know what I mean? It's giving them hopefully all the tools that they need and people they can connect with, and they decide how to use that going forward.
And you mentioned the 12-step approach there, which, look, not everybody relates to. And myself and Tony did a few episodes on it where we tried to unpack some of the stuff. And obviously millions of people around the world do relate to it, right? So, but at the same time, it's not for everybody, and there's no one approach that is for everybody. But I suppose if you're differentiating it from the 12-step approach, what specifically would differentiate it from that?
Several things. What I always say is that this program is about thriving, not just surviving. And my experience of GA, I would never say a bad word against GA, because I know that it has worked for so many people. I think it's a fantastic program if it works for you. But And a lot of women will say that they don't like it because it's male dominated and there's all these kind of ideas. I didn't find that. I went in and everyone was fantastic. What I would say was I didn't relate to the book, the steps, and I also didn't feel like the people there were really thriving in their recoveries. It felt very solemn. Maybe it was just the meetings I was going to, I don't know. But everyone was really nice. Now they felt that because I was the only woman in the room that I should maybe have a woman to talk to. So they put me in contact with a lady. Don't know where she was living, but anyway, I gave her a call, and I would just say like she wasn't living an inspiring life in recovery. She seemed very down and lonely, and you know, I suppose she reiterated the fact that at least she was in recovery. But for me, it just I didn't see the upside to being in recovery after I spoke with her, and I feel terrible saying that, but it just didn't inspire me the way that I needed to be inspired at that time. You know, and it gets to that point where, like, I remember going to my GP and, you know, I broke down crying in the surgery. I just really was so desperate for help, and she really did empathize with me, and she was lovely. But her answer was giving me antidepressants, and I knew at the time that wasn't what I needed. But I went out myself, you know, and I did a few things over the years, trying to get help. But there is this problem with when you try the tried and tested methods that work for everyone else and they don't work for you, and then you feel like you're a bigger failure because not only have you got this awful addiction that you know, takes over your life and your mind, but you also can't even get better. And it's a truly horrible place to be, and people don't realize it, and I never would have realized it before experiencing it. But one thing I would say is it really isn't prejudice. It can hit anyone, and I certainly never expected it to hit me.
Yeah, and that is a horrible feeling. I think that the idea that you're failing at controlling your relationship with the thing, if it's gambling or alcohol or whatever the addictive thing might be, and then to go for some sort of treatment or support and feel like you're also failing at that, when in reality it's just not the correct approach for you as an individual. It doesn't resonate with you as an individual. Many, many, many people find themselves in that position, and that's why it's so important that there are, that there's an option B or an option C or an option D or a combination of all the different options, so that the individuals get the support that re does resonate with them. And I suppose the other point, important point that I think you're making there is that there's much, much more to being in recovery than just abstaining from the thing, right? If it's gambling, obviously we talk about gambling here, but if it's alcohol, and it with alcohol, let's say within AA meetings, there's the idea of the dry drunk. So you're abstaining from alcohol, but you're miserable, right? You're hating every minute of it, right? But technically, you're in recovery because you no longer drink alcohol, right? And there isn't a word for that in gambling recovery, but I think the mindset still exists for some people where, okay, they're abstaining, but they're not really in recovery. Like what I would kind of pitch to people is that ideally your life in recovery should be much more enjoyable than your life in addiction. If it's not, there's a problem there somewhere,
Yeah,
Tony,
definitely.
thoughts? Jump in there.
Yeah, I suppose when Claire was speaking, I was the image was coming into my mind was kind of treading water. A lot of times in GA maybe or AA, it's kind of people are just existing or treading water in recovery. There's very little scope, and I think sometimes there's very little scope in the language used in the fellowships. And I'm not, again, I'd be very much of your mindset that it's something that works for millions, and it has worked. It's brilliant. It definitely held me at the start and really helped me in my early recovery. I think it helped me more so because I didn't feel alone at the time, and I felt the connection with the people rather than the process. I felt I got more out of the cup of coffee afterwards than I did out of meetings per se. But I think it definitely, recovery has to be more more than just not gambling. It has to be learn how to enjoy life again, how to live, how to get kind of happiness out of small things again, which gambling can totally take away, or any addiction can take away. And that does take sometimes a different approach. And that's why it is so, so important to have people develop different types of programs. Because I really loved your point around, you know, I felt like I was failing at recovery. And I think that must be totally kind of just soul destroying when you feel like you're failing at the one thing that you feel should be getting you out of one thing that has been dominating your life for so long. What I felt going through my own journey of GA is that, yeah, it really worked for me at the start, but then I felt stagnant in it. And I it's something I don't use anymore as part of my recovery, but I know it's there if I need to go back into it. I remember I was at a meeting a while ago, probably my one meeting in for a while, and I remember thinking to start, now I know why I don't come to these meetings anymore, because it just felt the same conversation was there years after I'd heard. But then by the time I was leaving the meeting, I was kind of going, I got something from it. So I think it does work in that sense for lots of people. Do I use as part of my recovery? I don't, but I think I use the ethos of it, or the elements of it in my recovery. That ability to have or show vulnerability and be vulnerable, the ability to speak openly and honestly around recovery, the ability to accept it's something I can never do again. And I think if you can mold that into a different type of program that's more accessible to people, or more, I shouldn't use the word more modern, I think that can only be a good thing. So it's good that there's a lot of these programs popping up, because it is like the saying, there's plenty of ways to skin a cat. It's kind of, if one approach doesn't work, there has to be another approach. And for so long, if you go to GP, it is antidepressants, or there's your local GA meeting, or there is a local addiction counselor. It has to be something a little bit different as well. And that's why I love the fact that you've incorporated your own experience of your coaching skills into a recovery program. And even just kind of going down through the different weeks, which I'm sure you'll talk about, it really will help someone in early recovery, but also can help someone to maintain that recovery. I think that's a very important aspect of it.
Yeah, because I think it's funny, one thing you said there about GA, I accept that I can never gamble again. I think that that's something I really struggled with for a very long time. And maybe on one level, I just completely denied that from GA, and it turned me off as well. Because you're so delusional. You know, I was only thinking about this this morning, actually, about how you can be so split personality when you're in addiction. Like, I had complete self-loathing for myself, constant anxiety, depression, and I just felt awful the whole time I was in recovery. And yet I had these complete delusions of grandeur at the same time, because I would go and I would gamble every single day, every penny I had. And even when I was down to my last euro, for some reason, I really believed that last euro was going to turn into 100 and then turn into 1,000. And it's a very, very strange place to be when you're in addiction. And I mean, for me, that was a 9-year addiction. So it stole my 20s, I guess, is how I'd put it. And, you know, it's just, I look back now and I think about all the times that it took away from me, you know. If I look back to that whole 9-year period and I think about the amount of like family occasions and you know, what should have been good moments in my life that didn't exist because I was there in body but not in mind. And my mind was always elsewhere, just waiting to get to the next bookies or waiting to log on to my laptop or whatever it was. It's hard to think about now how I lived that way for so long, but there's this adrenaline going on while you're while you're in it. And because you feel like I have to win back all the money I've lost, I have to pay this, I have to do this, it keeps you going, but eventually it exhausts you to a point where you can't function anymore. I totally went off tangent there, I apologize, but it's just, you made me think about that. And it's, so yeah, so sorry, my point was that recovery, it's not just the day you stop, you know, and I think that that really was something I didn't realize either. You know, you think if you stop that that's it, but when I stopped and the day I stopped, the whole next day was counting the hours that I haven't gambled, you know, and then that whole week was counting the days. And I'd say I lived like that for the first 3 months, counting each single day. And then, you know, once they got to a week, I'd say, well, you've gone a week, right? So you've gone a week without gambling. You can go another week. You can do this, you know, and it kept going like that. I'd say after 3 months, I stopped doing it that way. And I kind of just started trying to live. But it's like learning to walk again. You've been absent from the world. You've totally ignored everything around you. You've lived in this complete false reality for almost a decade. And then you have to learn how to live in the real world and you know, actually pay your bills and actually structure your life in a way that you're going to move forward because you've been stagnant for so long. And I think that, you know, I'm over 2 years into my recovery now and I feel fantastic being there, but it's been such a journey. And every day there is, you have to maintain that recovery. And I would be lying if I said that, you know, the days when I'm broke that I don't think about gambling is probably the first thing that comes into my head. But I've learned the skills now that I can talk to myself and rationalize it myself, which is something I could never do in recovery or in addiction. I can say, no, that's not the right way to do this. But it is the first thing that pops into my mind out of habit. And luckily I don't do that, but it's like, that's over 2 years down the line. And that's still my first reaction to, oh shit, you know, I need money. It's normalized to me. And, I'm grateful that I don't go there, but I'm just saying that you don't really realize when you're starting out how hard it is to keep in that recovery space, you know, and keep your mind on track.
Yeah, and I think it's great for people listening to know that, because people often ask, you know, we're obviously working with people kind of the first days and weeks and into maybe a few months for people. And they're asking, you know, will I ever stop having these thoughts about gambling? And you know, maybe not, but having, like, you have 60,000 thoughts a day, like, we don't act on all of them or else it would be just total chaos and anarchy and a bloodbath and whatever else, right? So we have the capacity to have an automatic thought pop into our head, and over time to learn the skills to challenge that thought and say, no, I'm not going to do that. That's a bad idea. Been there before, worn the t-shirt. I know what the consequences of that are going to be, and have a little chat with ourselves and challenge it with practice over time. Like, but would you say it gets easier over time to have that chat with yourself?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I don't want to scare people and say that, you know, you're always going to be thinking about gambling. That's not true. I even though I work in this space, I actually rarely think about gambling myself. It's definitely easier. I think the first 3 months were hard, because not just because it's hard battling your demons, I suppose, but because you've lost the trust of the people around you. That's the hardest part, and you have to regain that trust and you have to rebuild it. And I struggled with that, because you do have this obnoxiousness, let's be honest, when you're in addiction and you're driving everyone away. And even when they're telling you have a problem, you ignore them or you don't want to talk to them. So there's still an element of that I felt in early recovery where, you know, if anyone wanted to ask me a question or challenge me, I wasn't able for it. But again, that just builds, because I really made such an effort to prove to people around me that I had changed and that I was changing. And I think what really helped me do that was that I knew myself for the first time in a decade, I wasn't lying, you know, because I lied all the time to cover my tracks. And not because of that's who I am, but because that's what the addiction does to you. I'm actually quite an honest person, I would say, but in that headspace, I wasn't able to be. It completely takes over your mind. It's like battling a demon every day, and every day that demon wins. And it's heartbreaking. But like I say, I think the determination to just not hurt the people around me anymore, you know, that drove me through. That's what I'd say.
Tony, you wanted to come in there.
I was going to just, when you were talking there, like Anthony DeMello will say, like, when you fight something, you give it strength. And that's the kind of surrendering, and that's the acceptance bit of the fellowship meetings, is the surrendering the outcome that you can never do this again. I think once you do that, I think it's not in your mind as much. And I think the gambling is always there. It's a bit like grief. It's always there, but I think we grow around it. It's not that the grief minimizes or the gambling minimizes over years. I think we grow as a person around, so it becomes a smaller part. And that growth you're talking about is part of what you do in your program. It's like you help people to grow around or grow in recovery. So that the addiction, I think, is always there. And it's always the ability to that go to place when you have a bad day, or when you have an unexpected bill come in, or when that bloody engine management light comes on your car again after you're only spending the fortune on getting it fixed. it's that initial kind of thing. Oh, I have to go, you know, I have to go and gamble here to fix this or to escape from this. I will always talk about my smoking experience. Like, you know, the first couple of weeks after I get cigarettes, it's kind of like you're counting the days you haven't had one, or you're kind of you're wondering, like, will I ever not feel the need to have one with a cup of coffee? And then suddenly, as you said, after a couple of months, you wake up and kind of went, geez, I had a cup of coffee this morning, I didn't think about the cigarette. And I think it's only then when I always talk about the story when I was back in prison, when I was surrounded by it again, smoking, like, you know, there was nothing else to do in there. You know, you're working in the kitchens and every tea break, everyone smoked bar you. And you're seeing people actually rolling the cigarettes, or you're seeing them, you know, you're hearing the sound of the tobacco when it's lit, and you hear and you smell it, and you, suddenly it becomes part of your life again. I remember sitting in the cell, and I had the tobacco, but I didn't have a lighter. And it was that New Year's Eve. I was bored. I was there from 6 o'clock, banged out in the cell. You know, 12 o'clock, you were looking at the telly, and I had an overwhelming urge to roll a cigarette and have one. And if I had a lighter that night, I could have given into it, but I didn't. I kind of went through the urge. And that's a little bit like gambling. If you have taken away the means to do it, and that's why the control measures that myself and Barry talk about are so, so important. In that moment when you're not quite at your 100%, you can get through it. And I think when you grow around your addiction, or grow in recovery, or do that personal development work in recovery, the thoughts will never leave. And as Barry said, if you act on every thought, so would be carnage, but the thoughts never leave. But if we can recognize those triggers and recognize those thoughts and those irrational beliefs and gambling fallacies that Barry touched on earlier on, if we can grow around those, recovery is possible. And I loved Richie Sadler in his book, named his book Recovering, because that's what it is. It's not being stagnant in recovery. It's about learning how to tweak it. I'm a long time recovery. I constantly tweak in recovery, as you are a long time recovery now, and you're constantly tweaking as well. That you have to tweak it as you're going along, because otherwise we become just stagnant. And that's the word that just keeps popping into my head today, that stagnant in recovery. And if that happens, then it's the, what the fuck am I doing this for? What's the point? And then that's when the old thoughts of, oh, sure, it's only a tenner. Oh, sure, it's a bit more excitement. I deserve it. All those thoughts that can come back in our head. So it was just when you were speaking there, I have a lovely picture that I send clients sometimes. It's like a ball in a small jar. The ball is just barely fits in the jar, and it describes grief as the jar gets bigger, and the grief is still the same size, but the jar gets bigger. So it's something I use a lot as a visual for how we grow around different things in our lives.
I like that actually. I'm a big fan of like sayings and stuff, and there's two that I use a lot talking to myself and talking to other people. One of them I feel like I got from you, Tony, so correct me if I'm wrong, but it's don't give up everything for one thing when you can give up one thing for everything. Maybe it wasn't you then. I don't know. I don't know where I got that, but it really has stuck with me the whole time. Because I think it's very, very powerful, because you very easily can lose everything around you because of this one thing. And realizing that and acknowledging it does help the recovery process as well. Another one is, do you know that Chinese proverb? And it's like the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago, and the second best time is now. So I tried and failed 1,000 times, before I got there. And I'm there. As in, I'm here, but I have to keep staying here. And I know that every day as well. And just something else you were saying about growing around your recovery. When I was getting into recovery, and I know I had a lot of chats with you at the time, I had this belief that I needed to be taken away. I had to go to residential, and there was no cure for me if someone didn't literally take me away and lock me up. And I was convinced for a very long time that was the only way I was going to get better. But because I had small kids, I didn't have that option. And I think in one way that was another reinforcement of, great, now it's probably the only thing that's going to help me I can't do. But what I would say now is that it was actually the best thing that ever happened to me, not having to go to residential, because I had to learn to get into recovery and sustain recovery in my own environment. And I feel like I'm a lot stronger for that, because if I had been taken away, stopped gambling for 12 weeks or 20 weeks, whatever it is, and had to come back into this environment that I'd left as a bomb site, I don't think I could have done that. It's little by little, it's day by day. And that's when you go back to GA, they have some great phrases. They have some, the one day at a time, that's universal. Doesn't matter what program you're following. And the Serenity Prayer is another one that, I mean, everyone uses, I think. So a lot of things really are, universal. It's just how you present them and how you connect with them. And there's the other saying, I suppose, is, Johann Harry's, I use it all the time as well, about the opposite of addiction is not sobriety, it's connection. There is nothing truer in my opinion. And I go back to that with the program, because what I really want is to see this grow as a network, and people to connect. Because I had to, I ended up, I'm going to say, basically stalking people on the internet, trying to get in contact with other people who were in recovery. And it always led me to the UK, because in the UK they were doing all this stuff that wasn't going on here, and I was fascinated. But I made great connections through it, and I still have those connections, and it helped me very quickly build a peer support network. And it was nice to feel accepted into that network, but it was a pity that I didn't really have that here, because I didn't go to the one peer support program there was. So I hope that we can, I hope that we can create that here. And I know down the line these things will progress. It's just we're very behind, and it's really sad to see how much has been developed over there, and how little we've done here, and not through any fault, but the fact that we don't have the resources to do it.
Don't start myself and Barry on a rant.
Well, maybe to do a short rant, because yeah, I think it was, oh God, at the Hazelden Clinic, but I think it might have been back in the 70s. They're trying to develop the Minnesota model. They'd already developed it, but they were trying to pilot it in Ireland, and they came out and they did a pilot of it in Ireland. It's similar to the 12-step approach, But they kind of, when they came back to Hazelden and they did their report on Ireland, they said that it would never work here because we have a post-colonial mindset and we're too secretive. I think there's probably still an element of truth in that, where if you, again, myself and Tony, you know, even if you look at the guest list on this podcast, what percentage of them are from the UK? Now, we have plenty of people in recovery in Ireland, but you know, who may not be open about it, may not speak openly about it, who certainly may not wish to come on a podcast and talk about it. And I think there is that, still that kind of shadow of secrecy and shame and stigma, not just around gambling addiction, but about around many, many things in this country, which presents a challenge. I think it's improving. It's probably improved since the Hazelden crowd were over here somewhat. People are talking more about, say, their mental health and other things that might be going on for them in their lives. But I mean, in terms of, let's say, in your own program, like, are you looking for Irish participants to join your program at the moment?
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, it is a pilot right now, you know, and I've had to move the start date back to November. I had hoped for October, but it's looking more like November now, which is fine. But what we're hoping to do is pilot at least three groups over the next 6 months, and do it with about six service users per group, because I do feel like having a group is better. That's not to say that if someone came and wanted one-to-one, you know, support, that would be available to them as well. But I think it's nice because you had Lisa Walker on here last season, and Lisa's a very, very good friend of mine. And I'm sure she spoke about the New Beginnings program, which is a peer support program for women through Bet No More in the UK. And it's Lisa's baby. So that started, I think it was May, we started that, and she asked me to be a facilitator on it. And because I did that, they were able to open it to Ireland for signposting and stuff like that, which was great. And there was, I'd say, like half the women on it were Irish. They were delighted with this and happy to have this support. One thing we kind of realized through that program was that that there was 10 service users per group, and there was two or three of us facilitating. It seemed to work best when there was only maybe five or six people, and we had a 2-hour slot there, and it just felt like that was enough time. It was enough people that everyone got their chance to talk and to go through the topic and share with you know, it just worked with that number of people. And that's why I say six, because I feel like I've learned from that, and I think any more might complicate things and then other people don't get the chance to come in. So trying to keep it intimate enough that, you know, everyone can play their part, and if some people need more support than others, then that's fair enough. Because one thing I will say is I think everyone has a mutual respect for each other in recovery. And maybe that's not always the case, but I've certainly found it to be a very open and safe and welcoming space once you actually enter it and embrace it. And everyone at the end of the day just wants to get better, and they just want their lives to improve. And if there's someone there who's willing to help you do that, why wouldn't you want to be a part of that? You know?
I'm sold. So how can, if somebody's listening to this, like most of our, not all, but most of our listeners are in Ireland, how would they contact you to find out more about participating in the group?
So at the moment I'm doing content for a website, so I haven't gone live with that at the moment because I'm a bit of an OCD person and I want it to be really good. I was like, don't do it yourself, Claire. But yeah, look, on Twitter, Thrive Recovery, on LinkedIn, on Instagram, or even, you know, find me through any of those and message me. Definitely happy to chat to anyone interested in the program. Like I say, we probably won't be starting until November, but we, you know, contact me anytime, and I'm happy to to talk through it, and yeah, we'd be delighted to get more people on board.
Brilliant. Now, before we finish up, you mentioned something at the start about self-limiting beliefs and enabling beliefs. You better unpack those a little bit.
Yeah, I'm gonna show myself off for the fraud that I am now. yeah. So when I started the course, this was all very new to me, and we had an option for mentoring, I guess, with the professionals who were doing the course. So I thought, right, okay, I'm going to do this because I want to see how she does it. And, you know, she's the master and I want to be part of that. So I had this master coaching session with the lecturer, and she was like asking me what my agenda was, what did I want to work on today, that kind of stuff. And I had generic stuff, to be honest, that I was presenting to her. And then she just kind of cut into talking to me over and over again about my values. And I say, well, my values are this, this, this. And she go, right, but what else? But what else? You know, and she kept going. And she kind of made me think about things that I never would have thought about. And I'm writing this list, and it's suddenly a page of stuff that never even entered my head before. So that we did all that. And then we went into what I was talking about, which was, you know, a situation where I wanted to do something, but I was afraid of what other people would think if I did this, which is a normal thing. You know, we all experience that. And she kept questioning me on why I was afraid to do this. And I kept saying, like, that I just don't want, you know, people to think this of me or to think that of me. And she kind of reinforced through just keep questioning me. She made me realize something, which was that I was making a life decision based on what someone else thought someone else was going to think of them because of what I did. Right. So I think that was something I'd never realized before. Like, I've realized it on some level. So this self-limiting belief for me was that, you know, oh, I could never do that. I could never do that because of this reason or that reason. And then the enabling belief for me was, but why can't I do it? What, like, what's stopping me from doing it? Why would I make a life decision based on someone else's opinion? It was a completely different mindset for me. And I just, like I say, it really blew my mind. And now I would use that example talking to people. And like I say, it sounds crazy to think that you would decide something based on not even what the person you know thinks, but what they think someone else will think of them. Crazy, right? But unless someone reinforces that, sometimes you're never going to see that.
It's called Twitter.
Remind me when you're
there, and if any of my clients are listening to it, they'll probably be sick of me talking about this, but I read a very interesting book recently called 4,000 Hours, Time Management for Mortals. And to talk about, like, 4,000 hours is the amount of time you have if you live till 80, or sorry, 4,000 weeks, beg your pardon, 4,000 weeks time management for mortals. And it's the amount of time we have if we live to 80. So I've kind of made it up. I've roughly about 1,140 weeks left if I live to 80. And he used the analogy, which I've heard of before, of the teacher who brings in the rocks, the pebbles and the sand, the students, and asks them to fit them all into the jar. And the students put the sand and the pebbles in, they can't fit the rocks in. And he used the analogy of, it's a little bit like values, or a little bit like, and you could use it for values, or you can use it for things that are important in life. Like he said, like, what are the really important things in your life? Because he talks about how much time we give to things that aren't important. And, you know, like, if I look at things that are important in life, it's like, your relationships, family, my daughter, kind of connecting with people, music, football, reading. Work isn't even in the top seven. Sorry, Barry. But work isn't even in the top seven. But they would be kind of rocks that generally I should be putting into the jar first. And then the pebbles are the kind of work and kind of stuff like that. That's stuff that are important, but stuff that at times maybe I give too much of my time and effort. And Barry again would always be on to me to pull back from different things, because at times I tend to get OCD as well, and or I wouldn't know if OCD is the right way I've described it, but I tend to kind of can't slow down at times. And what I tended to try over the last couple of weeks, and again, when you said values, you could do it with values. Well, what are my values that are really, really important? And what are the things then that are not so important? So if you focus the majority of your time on stuff that's really important, you tend to get a life that's a little bit more fulfilled and a little bit more enriched. And the sand in my life is likes of social media, likes of Twitter, the stuff that doesn't really give a shite at the end of the day, but stuff that we think, oh, what's he going to think? What's she going to think? And then you're listening to people's opinions, and then suddenly it kind of gets in on your thinking for a day and makes you become negative thinking around a certain idea or a certain thing. And you find yourself angry at the world. Like I watched a thing on Twitter there a couple of weeks ago where there was a goal disallowed for, it was against Man City. And it was a similar type of goal at Liverpool, it disallowed in the Champions League, or was allowed against Liverpool in the Champions League final. And I was scrolling through this and I was getting angry of the whole injustice of the whole thing. And I kind of going, at the end of the day, does it really matter? And I think that's what I've tried to do, I suppose, is to kind of look at what's really important and put those stuff first in my very little remaining weeks of my life. I don't want to sound morbid around it, but it gets you to think around the time we put into stuff that's not really important. And if you look at that in a value-based system as well, I think you could, it's just something there as well. And then, yeah, we can put the pebbles in on top and we can put the sand in on top. Like, there's space where obviously work is a big important part of a lot of our lives. But the likes of the sand, like the social media or other people's opinion of you or whatever else might be there, I sprinkle a little bit of that on top. And before that would have been everything, especially in early recovery. What do people think? What are people thinking about me? I have to connect with everyone, or I have to be this, or I have to be that. And then work, obviously, then, because it was part of my identity of how I saw myself within the world, because it would have been one thing that was taken from me in recovery, that sense of identity from the job, having lost the job, being a manager. It was a big part of trying to get back to a certain level of, well, if I'm a brilliant counselor, then I've made it in life, or if I'm this or if I'm that. And over time, I suppose, as I've grown in recovery, it's coming back to the stuff that's important, like you said, like your family. And I know you talked about your two children as well a lot of time when we were chatting. They're front and center now as well. But at times we have to remind ourselves that at the end of the day, what we want to give all our the majority of our time to. And I think for so many people nowadays, it's to the likes of Facebook, to the likes of TikTok, to the likes of whatever else. I see my own daughter as well, consumed by it. And it's that kind of trying to get that balance back, but even more so tipping the balance into areas of our lives that we really want to, or that is really important to us, or that we really want to spend more time doing. So that's what kind of came up for me when you were speaking about the value system as well.
I probably didn't explain that as best I can, because it's probably more about mindset what I was talking about. But I mean, I suppose at the end of the day, you look at it and it's like, self-limiting is the doubting yourself, and enabling is the actually starting to believe in yourself and believe that you're capable, because what is stopping you? It's really about questioning yourself all the time and just reasoning with yourself and saying, well, what is actually stopping me from doing this? And that was the conversation I never had with myself. I would just cut myself down and say, right, you're not able to do that. You can't achieve this because you've never done it before. I think what they drilled into us in the coaching was, where's the evidence that you can't do this? And you look back and you go, well, there is no evidence that I can't do this. So then you go, well, maybe I can. And it's so simple. It's so simple. And yet it changed everything for me. I mean, you know, starting a company, that's madness to me. Do you think that like 10 years ago, I could have ever imagined that? No, but I just didn't let fear stop me this time, because why would I? it's a really nice place to be in recovery. And that is my point, I suppose, going forward, is that I want to see everyone do that, because you need to feel inspired. And there are a lot of inspirational stories out there, which I would be sharing with people through the program as well. Because I think that they really need to know there is a life after recovery, and it is better if you let it be better.
It's always CBT. You're after scribing cognitive behavioral therapy. It's also a bit on that, and I know Barry's going to come in to finish up, but the bit on that is like how we think impacts how we feel, and that's the kind of basis of CBT. So if we can get, it's like Christine Badeski, mind over mood. If we can change how we think in certain situations, it can have an impact on our feelings and emotions, which can lead us into a life that's a lot better, and we don't have to escape into mind-numbing gambling or alcohol or addiction to escape from it.
Yeah,
and so many of our beliefs don't have any evidence to support them. They are irrational, not just in active addiction with gambling or any other addiction. It goes far, far beyond that. So, you know, within that cognitive behavioral therapy model, you know, the core beliefs, the common ones being, you know, I'm not worthy or I'm less than, and then they drive the kind of rules and assumptions that we have about the world, and they drive the sorts of automatic thoughts that we have, that cognitive model. We might have a look at that in a bit more detail someday. But one of the things, because I suppose, just so we're not leaving our listeners confused about the word enabling, because in America, quite often the word enabling is interchangeable with empowering. And I would see what you're talking about as empowering yourself to face the fear and do it anyway, and kind of rather, because there can be confusion around the way we use enabling sometimes in the addiction world as well, where, let's say, family members can engage in enabling behaviors. That's not empowering, that's disempowering, where, you know, you're bailing out the person with the gambling problem, or you're facilitating the addiction in some way. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. Yeah. That's actually a very good point, because I'm going by what I've learned through a diploma and everything else. And that's just something that, to me, I didn't even know existed. So the word enabling to me makes sense. But yeah, you've made a very good point there. Empowering probably is more appropriate, and maybe I should change that in my program.
No, not necessarily, because it does have both meanings. But I'm just, in case, because we probably have touched on enabling behaviors from the negative definition of the word previously, so just we're not confusing anybody. It can mean both things. Oh God, there was something else in there, but of course I should be taking notes here. It's gone out of my head. Well, look, I mean, that the mindset side of things, I think, is so important, because I've seen it, let's say, back before I kind of started specializing more on the gambling side of things, around anxiety. Like the amount of people who go into the shop, and immediately when they go into the shop or the supermarket, the post office, whatever, they're thinking, oh, what are all the people in here thinking about me? They're thinking, oh, my hair is a mess, or, you know, why did I wear these shoes today, or my bum looks big in this, or whatever the thing is that, you know, that maybe they can see my bald spot, or whatever the thing is that people are thinking about us. In reality, everybody else in the room is just as self-obsessed as you are. They're up in their own heads going, oh, what's everybody thinking about me, right? Nobody else in the world is nearly as interested in you as you are, right? That's just the nature of being a neurotic human being walking around the place, right? And that's one of the things that holds us back, is this belief that because we see ourselves sort of as the center of the universe, that people are constantly thinking all these things about us. Social media doesn't help, because that reinforces the fallacy or the delusion that, you know, people are thinking about us, and they're commenting on our comments, and they're commenting on our pictures, and that they actually have some sort of an interest in our lives, when in reality they're much more wrapped up in their own stuff. Right? But that holds us back a lot, you know, holds us back from doing a lot of the things that we really want to do in our lives. Like, so I think, just before we finish up, I know we've gone slightly over the time here, but could you just briefly outline what the different elements of the program are?
Yeah, so like it's very basic tools and information that are created by lived experience, but there's also coaching tools thrown in there. So the first step would be, you know, using your skills to assess where you're at right now. And that's going to look different for everyone, where you're coming into this recovery program. But you'd look at that, you assess that, and you kind of spend the first week on that. And then, yeah, there's mindset. Self-care and boundaries is another one. And I think it's very important to highlight, because my self-care went out the window. Like, I could have left the house in a paper bag, never would have bothered me. I could have not showered for a week. I really did not care because all I thought about all the time was gambling. So to be honest, I probably would have preferred going around not having showered and people wouldn't come near me. That's probably, you know, the thing. That's how I felt at the time. Looking at stress and sleep and how you'd manage that and financial well-being, of course, although I wouldn't say I'm an expert on that, but we definitely cover it. Basics of life, your nutrition, your lifestyle, active lifestyle, building a support network and goal planning and, you know, moving forward. And then we'd have a lot of content with regard to other people's stories or, you know, things that would hopefully inspire, but also resources that would help you if you need a different kind of to go in a different direction or access different types of supports. Like, we'll try and provide you as many as we can and facilitate that as best we can. I feel like the content is what needs to be there, but obviously this is a pilot, so it's a work in progress, and I hope that the people doing the program will help inform that as we go along, because I'm certainly not rocking up here going, I've got it cracked, and I know the answers, because I don't. But I'd be very grateful to learn along with everyone else what is going to work, and they can help that. Like, it's just about helping people and building a network is really the priorities here. And just, I think that we experience so much stigma and shame in Ireland that we need to open up a different perspective to people. And you can get that through this, because, like, well, I'm the first Irish woman you've had on talking here, but maybe that'll open up to other women. And I hope it does. But I understand where they're at. But I think that we've got an opportunity here in Ireland now to raise awareness and to work together and create a safe environment for people to come forward. And we have to do that. And I hope that this program will do this, you know, and I know that you are doing that. So collaboration and, you know, just listening to each other and helping us to move forward and find what works is what's important. And I hope that through the next 6 months of this program, we can make that happen and maybe open it up to more stuff.
That sounds brilliant. And it does sound like you mentioned the word holistic earlier on, like that it needs to be the whole picture, whole life, whole person, rather than just, yeah, we'll take away this thing that's really bad for you, that you have this dysfunctional relationship with that's destroying your life, and you're good to go just through abstaining. Like, it has to be much more than that. And then I suppose even if you get kind of one positive habit up and running, it tends to have a positive domino effect, this kind of virtuous cycle, the opposite of the vicious cycle. And that sounds like exactly what you're trying to create there. And I suppose the helping within the network of people as well, which, you know, that's massively important. Tony, any thoughts or questions for Claire before we finish up today?
No, I suppose just to reiterate what you said earlier on about the power of the group. I think the group work is really, really important. But also, like, the way I always kind of approach it is, group work is so powerful. And Sister Consilio, where I don't treat people, we'll always talk about the power of the group. I think one-to-one kind of counseling has a space that, if there is a certain element that you want to bring into a kind of a safe, not a safer space, but just to kind of explore on a one-to-one basis, that's the value of that as well. But the group work can be really, really important to build up that kind of feeling that I'm not alone here. I think for anyone in early recovery gambling, that's that kind of sense you have, like, I'm totally alone here because why can't I stop? And I think you made a very valid point of failing at recovery. I think that's the one thing I'll take from today, is that thing, there's no such thing as failing at recovery. It's just the whole thing is that recovery is a process and that we have to keep on coming back and trying different things. And it sounds like the group will give hopefully many, many people the chance to explore different ways of getting into recovery and, more importantly, maintaining it.
That's
Claire, thanks so much for coming on today. And I mean, again, you have hammered it home. You are the first Irish woman that we've had on here. You to the best of my knowledge, you may be the only Irish woman who speaks openly about being in recovery from gambling addiction or gambling problem disorder, whatever name you want to put on it, which puts you in a very unique position. And hopefully more women, more men, more everybody will come out and speak more openly about it, so we can reduce the stigma and reduce the shame, and more people can feel comfortable coming forward to get the help that they need, if we can kind of minimize or reduce the stigma and shame around it. So if people are interested in the pilot, which will be starting around November, they can check you out on all your many, many different social media platforms.
I'm really bad at social media, Barry. I really am. But look, I'm there and I can be contacted. And, you know, website is under construction, but I won't plug that right now. So I think, yeah, just find me, or Thrive Recovery has a page as well on each of those platforms. So it'll be easy to find. And yeah, just message me.
Brilliant. Certainly the program sounds really, really good. And obviously it's a pilot. And like you said, you're trying to learn, which is the great mindset to have going in. Like anybody who thinks they have anything cracked scares the bejesus out of me. Right? That always worries me when people think they have something cracked. If you're going in with the beginner's mind or a learning mindset, you're always going to improve whatever you're doing anyway. So Claire Dunnigan, CEO of Thrive Recovery, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us today. And best of luck. And we'll be talking to people and hopefully making some referrals your way for the program as well, because it sounds brilliant. Keep doing what you're doing. Take care.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
The Problem Gambling Podcast is proudly sponsored by Gamban, the simple and effective way to block access to online gambling on all your devices. If willpower slips, Gamban doesn't. Go to gamban.com to find out more.